So good morning, everyone. Helen Kane, CEO of One MSL, absolutely delighted to welcome you all to this very important webinar on the topic of the evolving MSL and the needs to succeed. As you know, we run a webinar series and this is the second webinar of 2022. Very brief introduction for anyone who is not familiar with One MSL. Lots of words on the slide, but really we are absolutely driven by a passion and desire to maximise the impact of the MSL, the MSL leader, and indeed the wider medical affairs function. And I know we're going to talk about that in the context of this webinar. I am thrilled beyond belief to have such an esteemed panel, really. It's wonderful to have so many people who are willing to be part of the conversation. So I would like the panel to introduce themselves and briefly and also share with us the reason for why they're keen to be part of this conversation. So Amanda, shall we start with you?
Yeah, thank you, Helen. Morning, everybody. So I am Amanda. I was a nurse for 14 years and joined the industry as an MSL in 2005. Various roles, MSL roles, MSL manager roles in Actelion and Janssen, and I'm currently head of field-based medical affairs at Pharmacosmos. We have a large team of 8 MSLs, and we also have 2 advisors, a nurse advisor and a midwife advisor. So I'm thrilled as well to be here this morning. I'm biased, obviously, because I've been in the MSL role for a long time, but I think it's a really great role. And, you know, it's a real passion of mine. So I'm really interested to hear everybody's thoughts this morning.
Thank you. Kate?
Yes. Good morning, everybody. My name is Kate Bradford. I'm from the UK originally, but now based in Switzerland. And I've been working in sort of above country MSL leadership roles for about 8 years now, various different guises. And every time I try and move away from doing this kind of job, somehow I gravitate back. And that either means that, you know, I haven't done my job very well in making MSLs excellent, or actually the role keeps changing and evolving. And so hence, that's why I'm here. Similar to Amanda, I think I've always said the MSL job is the best job in the industry. And as it continues to change and evolve, I think I'm probably going to be in the MSL community for, well, maybe till I retire.
Fabulous. Thank you, Kate. Paul.
Oh, hello, everyone. Thanks so much for the invitation. I appreciate it, especially since I'm fairly sure, I haven't checked, but I'm fairly sure I'm the least qualified person on this panel. I certainly have the fewest letters after my name, that's for sure. But I really appreciate the invitation. I run a company called Impatient Health, and I used to run the largest events in the industry. So I suppose my perspective on all of this is outside in a little bit. But I absolutely believe, and will happily say this to any audience within our industry, I believe that medical affairs are the most important part of our organization going forward and very much the future of our industry.
Thank you, Paul. Sharon.
Hey everyone, I'm Sharon Hotchkiss. I'm a senior pipeline medical science liaison at AbbVie. I've also come from a nursing background, many years at the Christie, and then came via commercial patient relation managers through that role into the MSL. Like Amanda, completely biased. I think it's the best role in the industry and I'm not for being ousted anytime soon. So it's a real privilege to be here today and to meet everybody.
Thank you, Sharon. And last but by no means least, Steve.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me. Absolutely delighted to be here. Such an important conversation, as you said, Helen. So my name's Steve Medhurst. I head up the UK Field Medical Excellence at Novartis UK. I've had a career spanning around 24 years, makes me feel very old, both in research, R&D for the first half and then the second half medical affairs in the field role, whether it's MSL, MSL manager and field medical excellence. So I've been quite fortunate. I've not only seen this spectrum from the pipeline, from drug discovery, from really at the very early stages, even before powders are made, through all the way through to the delivery of medicines, whether it is from pre-launch through to launch through to established medicines as well. So feel fortunate because I've seen that. Also, the MSL role, I've been able to, in the 11 years I've been MSL in the field of medical, just seeing that evolution, moving from a purely reactive through to that sort of proactive and insights sort of drive through now to something completely different, which is, you know, more healthcare thinking and healthcare system thinking and trying to really transform medicine. So yeah, really looking forward to the discussion, as you can tell. Thanks for inviting me.
No, thank you so much, everyone. So I'm going to start by setting the scene. And you know, we've all heard so much about medical affairs being the third pillar of pharma. And I prefer this visual. I'm super visual. And I just think this is a really nice representation of kind of the evolution, the journey that we're on in terms of medical affairs. But really, I just wanted to start by showing these three publications. And these are just three of a huge number of publications that are out there talking about medical affairs. But what is so interesting about these publications, and for Paul Sims in particular, is that these date back to 2018. 17, 18. So, you know, over the last 5 years, we have been having this conversation about the evolving role of the MSL, the importance of the MSL, the vision for medical affairs, and the place, you know, will medical have its seat and its voice at the table? So before we get into the actual MSL role itself, I'm going to kick off with Paul, because Paul, as our expert outsider, let's call you that.
I know
that you have a particular, you have some thoughts about really the greatest opportunity for medical going forward. So would you like to comment on that at this point?
Yep, I'll be volunteered, I guess. Appreciate that. And by the way, I'd love to know if people agree or disagree. So do please speak up. So you alluded to it that medical affairs, a couple of people mentioned, you know, moving from the support to strategic, moving from reactive to proactive. That's very well true, but I still feel that we're only 10% of the way. And we've got a magnificently wonderful and exciting road ahead of us, because as I said, I think that medical affairs indeed should be the most important part of the organization. Why do I say that? Because every industry on this planet, even those not dealing with life and death like we do, requires authenticity to be at the absolute heart of its communication and indeed everything that it does. Medical affairs, in my opinion, is the only part of the organization, certainly the only part outside R&D, that is able to prioritize learning and authenticity, of course, beyond anything else. We talk about how our industry has a poor reputation, about how we need to become more agile and more experimental going forward. And I would say that, for example, the commercial side of our organization has been screwing up this whole agility thing for at least 5 years now, because, you know, imagine a traditional sales rep getting to the end of the year and saying, you know what, I've not really made any sales, but I've learned a lot. They're not going to last in their job for very much longer. Whereas in medical affairs, you have this ability to really listen and to ensure that those insights from all stakeholders, but particularly HCPs, penetrate the rest of the organization in a very authentic way and actually define what it is that we do as a company. I believe that medical affairs should be setting the narrative, should be setting the storyline. It shouldn't even be up to the CEO. I think that medical affairs are more qualified to be able to create those narratives that would actually end up improving the reputation of our company and thus improve our external interactions on almost every level. So I guess I just wish, you know, I get asked to speak at many, many medical affairs meetings, and I'm always told at the beginning, Paul, if you could just help us, you know, think about ourselves a little bit better and gain some confidence in what we do. It really pisses me off that after all this time of talking about going from, you know, support to strategic, we're still grappling with knowing who we are and knowing our position and our place in the world. We are the most important, I say we here, you are the most important people in the company. And you should not be fighting for a seat at the table, as unfortunately, you know, things have improved over the course of the pandemic, but it's absolutely not the case that that should still be. Every industry, you know, prioritizes content marketing. You are the content, you know, you are the ones that actually know what's going on. So yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated, I guess, that we are still sort of grappling with this confidence problem when it should be really the reverse. So I'll just stop there because, you know, I could rant for the rest of this webinar and point out we've got some interesting people to talk to. Here,
so. Well, I think you've set the scene really nicely, and I can imagine that there are lots of whips going on in the background and lots, you know, you've rattled the cage, Paul. So that was why we invited you. We thought it was great to have you rattle the cage. So let's now try and link that, because I think that this is really an opportunity. I think you've set the scene so clearly, you know, and it is so fascinating, because often when we're within a company, it's very hard to see beyond what is happening within our own organization. And But let's now go to this question. So Kate, if I can kick off with you, is that okay? Can I put you on the spot and ask you to kick off? Thinking about what Paul has just said and thinking about this idea of the evolving MSL role, what are your thoughts on this?
No, I mean, I think, you know, Paul, that really resonated with me. And I think one of the challenges we have is we are shifting much more towards capability building with MSLs. So we'll equip our field teams on the ground and say, look, we're going to help you be more confident and believe in your role and have better discussions. And it's going to take a while for those people to migrate to the top of organizations, because it's actually our medical leadership and directors that maybe don't get that training. So that was my takeaway from what you said, is maybe we need to shift gears with some of our capability building. In terms of the evolving MSL role, no, I think for me, I'd say we're probably further than 10% there, Paul. So I'm going to disagree with you. I think we're maybe at 15, right? As much as that. but what I observe is, you know, we went through a period of people not really knowing, you know, what is an MSL? What do you do? How do you show the return on investment? What's the value? But if you now start to Google and look for MSL jobs, there are hundreds of field-based medical roles of all different variations. So you have clinical liaisons, clinical trial liaisons, patient journey partners, medical partners, precision medical liaisons, oncology medical education associates. I went through this morning and I just thought, I'm just going to have a look. If I Google medical liaison, what comes up? And a lot of these roles are much more focused on the pipeline. So that's an evolution I see, is that we're sort of moving to the left. And while we may have established our relationship with commercial and how we engage, what we're doing a lot more of is engaging with R&D. And then post-pandemic, I think there is an expectation of, well, what are you actually going to do for the business? You know, we realize access is difficult now for sales colleagues. So there's going to be a lot of focus on field medical teams. And as we evolve, we have to be ready maybe for some more radical changes to actually personally step up and say, well, we're not going to wait for somebody to come along and say, how do we evolve your role so you go from 10% confidence to 60-70%. Actually, we have to drive that. So that would be my comments, Helen.
Thank you, Kate. So let's go to an in-role MSL. Sharon, let's hear from you. What are your thoughts on this?
It's really interesting listening to Kate and Paul. I'm really passionate about the role of the MSL. And I actually think that people are very quick to want to move from the MSL role. And I just feel that there's so much that you can gain from being an MSL for a good, you know, at least 5 years, the skill set and everything else. And there's just such opportunity coming out of the pandemic at the moment. We're learning to use omnichannel. We're developing new skills. And I just genuinely believe, Helen, that what we need to have is a core group of really sort of involved MSLs that perhaps don't want to move, that are that foundation and they're the backbone. Because to me, we're the people that link with the clinicians. We are that voice that goes from the community back into the organisation. And it's also about building your relationship internally so that as you bring those insights back and you learn to fight for your clinician, and for the people that you're working with externally, that you then as a company start to move in the direction that suits everybody. And I think when we spoke at Farmer Field, I was very much showing the vision of one of the trusts that I worked with and how we were working in line with their vision as well, with trials, but also the inline. And I think it's really interesting what Kate said about the diversity of role. I'm now in a pipeline role myself, having come out of an inline role, as they call them, but the skills are so varied. So for me, I think there needs to be a framework that actually encourages people to stay a little bit longer and to actually just keep developing within role as well. So I think the development piece is of importance, if that answers the question.
Absolutely. So Steve and Amanda, you know, I'm going to come to both of you. Steve, what are you nodding? What are your thoughts on this?
I'm nodding because I agree with everything, but I'm afraid, Paul, I'm not quite agreeing with your percentage either. And I'd probably increase it more because I think there's a lot of other work that I think it is going on in companies. And I think that the role is evolving, maybe not at the speed that we need it to because of everything else changing so rapidly. But I think there's also language that we use needs to change and evolve a little bit. I mean, even words like partnerships as opposed to relationships, aspects like that. We need a partner with the healthcare system and not just with prescribers. And we need to get that knowledge, and we need all that knowledge to be coming through in those and participating in those strategic meetings that we have internally, so people can really see that worth. Yes, insights are very important, and that's our sort of currency. It's a phrase I've often used. And so that goes somewhere along the line, but it needs to evolve more than maybe just opinions on the data. It needs to be understanding the interconnections between the healthcare system, not just the prescribers, and bringing those in. So I think the divide, I think over time, the range of stakeholders we need to see as well needs to be far wider and broader as well. Completely agree with Kate on the early engagement. That's certainly something that we're focusing on, because actually that's where we can really show our value on the front line, pre-license, pre-launch. That's where we get the insights to create the structure. No one else is doing that. So we need to go there to find those barriers or those opportunities before launch. And so that's always the difficult thing, because actually we need to be working in the background, doing all of this stuff and building strategic plans for the future launches, when actually the company are so fixed on the current launches and what they can do from that. So it's a difficult role, but that's what makes it so exciting. So just a couple of thoughts there. I mean, the range of stakeholders we need to go to, from, you know, payers, I think, bring those in. I know that from the data that from your survey suggested that payers are being seen a little bit, which is great, but then maybe in the future we'll see far more with maybe the patient societies or whatever, or even other players like digital medical experts or data analytics or other technology and all of that, just so that we are fully equipped with all the information to then participate. I mean, I'd be interested to know what Paul's thoughts are on the reasons why we might be a little bit shy at stepping forward and really pushing this great knowledge that we've got, whether it's down to the personalities amongst us within the medical arena and maybe not quite so loud voice, perhaps. I'm not making any aspersions about our colleagues in commercial, but any ideas on why we think that confidence isn't there would be really interesting to hear.
Yeah, happy to reply now or later.
Yes, but no, please, Paul, and then we'll come to Amanda.
Okay, multiple reasons. I'll just do two at the moment. So the first one is, why is it that medical affairs leadership isn't part of the overall company leadership in so many cases? Like, we have maybe a chief medical officer, but even that person isn't necessarily board level in so many companies, and often chief medical officer isn't even responsible for medical affairs. So the entire chain of medical affairs sort of sometimes finishes halfway up the chain of commercial. And, you know, I put a little piece on LinkedIn about 2 or 3 months ago about, you know, why is it that commercial leadership are often running medical affairs, which, you know, seems to be often the case. You know, we're happy with the sort of cross-functional working that has proliferated over the course of the pandemic, but you know, should at the leadership level it be that way? So I just think that medical affairs itself as an organization doesn't have enough of a seat at the table, which then filters through, of course, to the rest of the organization. That's an existential thing. You know, I'm lucky to be able to talk to CEOs occasionally. When I ask them this question, they sort of, you know, say, well, you know what, they've often grown up from the commercial organization themselves. It's just what they know, what they believe in. They like the idea that a commercial person will never leave the room without striking a deal, you know, and you know, with an eye on the P&L, they find that sort of short-term interest very important to them. So I would have liked to have seen that progress a little more than it has done so far. The other thing that I was thinking of, why is that? Well, yes, there is a sort of personality type, isn't there? You know, we are authentic, as I said before. We are, you know, we care much more about, you know, what's truthful as opposed to what's, you know, gonna score the most points. And that I spoke at a one company's event earlier this year, and the head of medical affairs got onto the stage just before me and said, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you because in this meeting, it was all of commercial and medical together. I'm so proud that you guys were still on the dance floor late at night. You are confounding, you are alleviating the reputation of medical affairs as always being the bookish ones that go to bed at 8 p.m. And I'm so proud of you. And that was the biggest message that she projected before, beforehand. So, I don't think the medical affairs should change their personality, by the way. I don't think it should be all about, you know, who stays latest in the nightclub. I think that the world itself should shift towards, as I said, becoming more content oriented. And it already has. We always, you know, everyone in commercial is talking about scientific content now. It's that combination of leadership and conviction. It has to be both top down and bottom up to actually change, I think.
So I think hopefully Steve, Paul has given you some food for thought there. I just want to say thank you to everyone who's contributing on the chat. So thanks, Mark Rees-Saunders. Mark has pointed out MAPS vision for 2030 for medical affairs leadership is that we're going to see this shift towards more organizational leadership being driven by medical. So thank you for pointing that out, Mark. Also, the conversation, and I think this is super important, and I'm going to come to Amanda really around this in a second. The comment about, you know, engaging earlier, but also people not being willing to stay in role, those findings come out very clearly in the survey. People choose to leave because of lack of what they perceive to be lack of development opportunities within both medical and the MSL function. So whether it's a mindset thing, I'm just using it as a stepping stone, but all of the incredible work that we do, if we're engaging earlier, but we're not willing to stay and build the relationships, all of that trust is lost. We lose that trust externally because we're not willing to really build those deep, long-lasting partnerships. So Amanda, I'll give you the final word on this point, because as you said, you know, you've been in this industry for a long time, you've been an MSL, you're now a field medical affairs leader. What are your thoughts on the role? What does it mean to you?
Thank you, Helen. So very, very interesting listening to what everybody said. So, you know, in 2005, it was, as we've discussed, very much a support function. You receive a request, you make an appointment, you deliver the data, you go home. And now that emphasis is, as we've just discussed, more on building longer term relationships with our stakeholders and our healthcare professionals. And as you've just said, Helen, to do that, you need to be in role, not just for a year or two. And you know, I completely agree with what Sharon said. And that's a challenge. And I think that's a challenge we need to address head on, especially the MSL leaders in this industry, because we need to make sure that we have the right environment for those MSLs to want to stay in role and to feel that they can not just stay in role, but be developed and see the value of their role. It's a big challenge. It's, you know, as Kate said, there's a lot of jobs out there and we need to make sure that they stay in the role they are in at the moment for a longer period of time to build those relationships. And that's all about development. It's about making sure that we take time to develop our team. It's very easy to say, it's a lot harder to do, but you know, that's the challenge. And it's certainly a challenge that I've been up for, as they say, since I took on this role at Pharmacosmos, because I think it's so important. Having been an MSL before, if I can see that, you know, it might seem like a small change, but if I want to be an MSL and develop to a senior MSL where I can mentor new to role MSLs, that's a really big, you know, really big step for a lot of people, and they feel valued and developed in the role, you know, as well as all the other training and development. And I think that that's, you know, even in the smaller teams, that's something that we should really consider, you know, how do we enable MSLs to stay in role and feel developed and valued?
I think there have been some very key points raised here, and I just want to come back to, you know, this journey that we're on, and this, you know, it's really fascinating sort of feeling part of the industry, but yet being outside of the industry, and we engage with a significant number of companies. And what has always frustrated me, I believe, is that somehow organizations are having to fight very, very hard to get the resources that are required to develop their people. You know, historically commercial, those resources were always there. There has always been a huge amount of emphasis. And I totally agree with Mark. I think we have some fantastic commercial colleagues out there, and we have some incredible medical, field medical teams and wider medical affairs teams. And whilst this webinar is very much focusing on the MSL role, let's not forget that the MSL is a member of the wider medical affairs team. So I think when I think about investment that needs to be made, when I think about resources that need to be dedicated, it's for the entire function. So on that note, I just want to really summarize. This is a slide we use quite a lot, really trying to depict this shift, this continuum from support function, that the role that I adopted when this was my role when back in the day when I was an MSL, I was firmly sat on the left-hand side of this slide. And this is the journey that we are wanting people to go on in order to really be recognized internally as that strategic partner. And in order to make that shift, that does require mindset and enhanced capabilities. But how do we know, you know, how do we have the opinions that we do? And it was Steve who kind of nudged me in this, and he said, you know, the survey findings really do call out the evolving role. And for anyone who hasn't seen the survey findings, please know that you can access them via the One Community. But the objective here was to understand current reality for MSLs and MSL leaders. And I'm just going to share with you three or four key findings to set us up for the next question. Before I do that, please know that this was truly a global survey, and you can see the participants and their locations reflected on this slide. And one of the questions that we asked, and Steve, I think, this comes back to your point and kind of your experience and linking back to both what Kate and Sharon are talking about, we can see here very clearly the shift in terms of engagement earlier in the drug life cycle. You know, the fact that we have MSLs of today even engaging at phase one, I find absolutely fascinating. And this is really demonstrating, because we know that this is an area where, of course, commercial are not able to engage. So we have this massive opportunity to be building very strong partnerships early and learn early so that we can influence strategy. We then also ask this question about stakeholder groups, and we see Steve, you commented on this, that actually the breadth of stakeholders that MSLs are engaging with is really becoming much larger. And when we think about the need for individualized engagement, the skills and capabilities that we have and the approach that we have for every group needs to be different, needs to be tailored, needs to be strategic. So we're starting to see that reflected. We then ask this question: do you believe that the MSL role in your organization is seen as a service function or as a strategic business partner? And we are now, a third of people are still feeling, so there is that perception that we're still sat on the left-hand side. So this really leads me to my next question. I'll start with you, Steve. So if the MSL is to be effective as a strategic partner, what do you believe they need to succeed? So what do we need to be doing to support them?
Yeah, thanks, Helen. Happy to kick this off. It relates to a question that's in the Q&A. I only had a quick glance at it. But I think one of the biggest things we need to do is how to balance what is expected of us. And I think it's when we've already said, and the data suggests, that MSLs are working earlier, which is not necessarily in the limelight of the commercial industry, then actually it's quite difficult to justify doing that to some people that maybe, and it goes back to Paul's point of the leadership, understanding the importance of medical in the early phases in order to prepare the future launches. And I think it's that sort of slightly narrow-mindedness that doesn't really help the MSLs really do their best in those early phases. But the balancing act also needs to be that MSLs can't just be by their desk researching, looking at patient journeys and looking at everything too early on, because actually they are customer facing. And I think it's trying to get that balance as well of understanding that you're the person on the interface, the front line, and also trying to make yourself the sort of CSO of your own region. So there's a huge amount to sort of sort out there, as well as thinking, actually, we've got a launch in a couple of years' time. I wonder what I need to understand more about in the patient pathway, the clinician's pathway, to understand what opportunities and barriers there might be at launch. So I think some of that thing is a bit of balancing, a bit of juggling, I think, to be able to do that. Because I think the pre-launch bit is extremely important to show our real worth and that engagement and the partnerships that we're able to do with healthcare systems. But then we also need to be there to help at the launch phase with some of the data as well. So there's just a few thoughts on that to kick things off. But actually, as you said, the data does show that it's hinting, and that's possibly going along to that percentage that Paul was talking about, the 10%. You know, a third is still considered as support, which is a shame. We know they're not a huge number going to the different external stakeholders. So we're getting there, but it's good to see it in the data.
Thank you, Steve. Amanda, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, Helen. Well, first of all, if it means that we have to be last on the dance floor or last to leave the dance floor, I'm quite happy to be that person, I'll have you know. but I think it is very much about strong cross-functional working. I mean, we say it, but it's about having the mindset that we can be that partner. We're not the support function. And I know that, you know, we've talked about 10%, maybe 15%, and I know we're nowhere near even 50% yet, but I think we are developing that mindset now ourselves. And if we begin to get that confidence ourselves, we can make that change. I think, as I said, you know, strong cross-functional working and building up, we talked about this, Helen, the trust internally. You know, we talk about, you know, building up the trusting relationships externally, but we need to do that internally as well. We need to show and just highlight our credibility, you know, our value. It sounds obvious, but the more we have confidence in ourselves to do that, the more it resonates. And I think we have that obligation to do that, actually.
Fabulous. Thanks, Amanda. Kate, I see you've come off. What would you add?
Yeah, I think we can learn a lot from small biotechs here, because, you know, in those small organizations, MSLs are talking to CEOs. You know, they're actually doing, you know, ride along scientific exchange together, because the CEO recognizes that the MSL is not just a tactical executor of, you know, a brand strategy, but is a massive source of information with great relationships that can, you know, short circuit expensive market research by doing one-to-one advisory boards every day. So I think, you know, how do you scale that up into large organizations? And I see this in my job at the moment, because I've effectively worked for the rare disease unit of AstraZeneca. So I'm in a small agile biotech in a huge organization. So it's a bit like sort of moving an oil tanker. I think it's going to take longer in the larger organizations for MSLs to be effective. As a, you know, for an individual MSL in a country, if you're the, I don't know, UK MSL for Hampshire, you know, how are you really going to influence, you know, the chief medical officer's decision making? It's going to be very difficult. So there is a reliance, I think, on MSL leadership, these sort of effectiveness and excellence roles, to really push that and say, actually, do you know what? You know, if you can exploit what you have on the ground floor with MSLs and the knowledge they have, then that will make you more, you know, a more effective strategic partner. That would be my comment.
Lovely. I think that's, I really love the, you know, that analogy, Kate, about, you know, go on a ride along, go and observe what happens. Yeah, the survey data is terrifying when you look at that, when you see that 30% of MSLs have no observed ride-alongs in 12 months. I mean, it's what a missed opportunity. So Sharon, I'm going to give the final word to Paul, though, in this instance. So Sharon, let's go to you next.
Yeah, I think Amanda, for me, you said really resonated. And I'm very lucky in that I've worked in small biotech and large companies. And it is the cross-functional working, and it's that medical affairs family team, which goes right back to what Paul said at the beginning. And I think if you're an experienced MSL and you're comfortable, you know where to go within your medical affairs team to work together. And I think for me, it's not about one person owning the strategy. It's the MSL feeding right in at very early stages to that medical plan, but knowing where your capabilities are. And then as a senior MSL, maybe guiding a new MSL, perhaps through their first, you know, clinical trial experience. So for me, the strategic bit is actually working really, really closely, not just within country, but globally as well. And we also feed back a lot to our commercial colleagues about what's going really well, some of the projects we're doing. And it's that two-way open communication as well, so that you know what's going on. But I think it's absolutely cross-functional working as part of a team and not in isolation.
Lovely. Thank you, Sharon. Paul, finally, because there's a lot of thank you everyone for being so engaged in the chat. It's quite distracting, actually. I'm trying to listen and I'm trying to monitor the chat. So there's a whole other conversation going on outside of this. So Paul.
Yeah, multitasking is not my superpower. So absolutely. I think actually what people have said so far is absolutely all in the right direction. I obviously would love to wave a magic wand and have it happen more quickly. I feel like it's been a few years since I've been you know, saying and been talking with people about many of the sentiments echoed today. I realize it doesn't happen overnight. The one thing that I could maybe add is, who owns the patient? And I realize no one owns the patient apart from the patient themselves, but who owns the understanding and the credibility that comes from being the true patient partner? What I have found over the last sort of 10 years or so is that patient engagement generally has become undemocratized. It used to be something which everyone in the organization was trying to do, but because of, you know, compliance, because of the cost and the time involved in recruiting a patient into whatever, you know, piece of research or engagement that you actually want to do, it's become the sort of preserve of a specialist team, often a patient engagement team, and they're very sort of isolated almost now. I myself spend a lot of my life trying to think, how can I, you know, retool the rest of the organization to engage with patients more rather than it having to be such a specialist role. I think, again, medical has a real opportunity here. And I do believe that medical already has too many things to do. So this is, you know, something of a pipe dream. But again, by being the ones in the organization to best understand the patient and to best engage with the patient, I feel that would, you know, set you up as a partner on a strategy level, but also many other levels within the company that furthermore sort of reinforce your importance to the organization. So that's the only thing I would add.
Fabulous. So, but I really, this is an opportunity for our participants, and we've got, it's fabulous. I mean, we've just got so many people on the line. We've got a poll for you. What do you believe are the top three greatest challenges for the MSL of today? I think this links back to everything that we're saying. It is so much easier to demonstrate commercial value. And of course, this is the panacea that we face. This is just the real issue. Is that it can be so challenging to truly demonstrate value and impact. And if the panelists like to comment on what we're seeing here in this poll.
It's amazing how there's no one clear winner that there often is in these polls. So clearly we have a lot of challenges. Sorry.
Yeah. And I think, I'm personally quite curious about multi-channel engagement, because I know, Sharon, you touched on omni-channel, and I have a frustration, I think, about, the whole word digital and how, this has become such a hot, organisations are investing millions and millions and millions around digital technology. And I think, at the end of the day, none of us, as far as I know, are avatars as yet. And we're still, very much in that human being mindset. So I just think, let's really continue to think about the skills that we need to have to really build those relationships that we so do not want to lose. I don't want us to see a day when our physicians are engaging only with Amazon, with an avatar within Amazon. Yes, that shift, digital engagement is the digital opinion leader is very much part of the new role. So let's move on. But thank you, everyone, for sharing your thoughts on that. And I just thought that I would share with you the findings from the survey. And this was really thinking back to what were the responses from all of the participants there. And of course, these findings are very reflective of the previous 12 months of COVID. And we can see here that the access piece, actually, I thought that came out more strongly within the poll here, that access, 50% of people felt that access was a challenge. And there are many, many reasons why that might be the case. But nonetheless, if we have the opportunity, we want to optimize it. So, and if I then show you one final finding. So when we think about the needs to succeed, this was a response from the survey. And this was, so what you can see is that we've done a sub-analysis here of the respondents' time in role versus what they believe there needs to be. So when you're thinking about your teams and you're thinking about where they are in their journey, you can see here that actually the individual development needs are varied and different. As we become more confident in role, we can start to appreciate the skills that we might need to have in order to be effective. So there's this massive shift here towards being what we call strategic acumen, and we're strategic thinking and acting. And this is a whole new area that we are focusing on. But for those of you that haven't seen that sub-analysis, hopefully that will give you some food for thought. So let's go to the questions and see if any of the panelists would like to take one of these questions. So someone has said, so let's push this out there. Steve, why don't I come to you with this? MSL should engage earlier. Investigator and pipeline support is not only the future, but an area MSLs can own. Do you think the challenge of MSLs engaging earlier comes from commercial push to drive medical to a more sales support environment?
Yeah, it is controversial. Thanks, Helen. I was just busy typing away. I'm trying to do this multitasking business.
You can't.
Question, but I think we touched upon this earlier. I think it's that balancing act, isn't it, of trying to work that through. I think that there is clearly some bigger sort of company pressure, I guess, on the here and now and sales figures. So that's obviously going to have some part. I don't know whether people have budgets put on one side for medical in early pipeline thing to even give it that sort of support and gravitas and show people that actually that part of the process is extremely important, with field medical being the only people that can really bring early insights in. So yes, I do believe that there certainly is a commercial push. I think that, but again, it goes down to it's what Paul said right at the beginning. Are we all absolutely convinced in ourselves that we know what we are all trying to do and what our role is and where we fit in as everything evolves and changes? Because that needs to change. You know, that healthcare system. I keep talking about that. It's not individuals, it's the whole healthcare system. We now need to understand who's interconnected with who, not just the prescriber. So, you know, are we doing our bit to really push our value through? Can we demonstrate actually examples where we have bought in insights to do with pain points in a patient pathway and then suggested some solutions and then had our place at the table and participate with the strategy? And so maybe we need to do more to show the commercial side of our value and our worth in that part, because again, that's an ideal place to do it, because that we're the only people there that can do that. So maybe we need to also show more of our value too. But yeah,
that's a thought. Anyone else like to comment on that question? Do you think is it personally? I don't agree that it's a commercial push. I think it's an opportunity, and it's something that I've believed in for a very long time, that it is an opportunity, but it's back to this long-term versus short-term objectives. Kate, any comments that you would make?
I mean, this is close to my heart. I've seen in the last two jobs I've done, actually I've worked with teams in the clinical phase as opposed to commercial phase, so MSL teams. And I think organisations are realising that the skill sets MSLs have are highly valuable in the early pipeline development setting, where, again, clinical operations tends to be a very transactional business. And if you can insert an MSL in that stage, you learn so much about, you know, your protocol design, your positioning strategy that will impact your launch downstream. So I see a huge shift in that, that the MSLs are engaging early. So, you know, I think Sharon, your role is going to continue to evolve, right? So as a career MSL, I don't think you're going to be bored. I think it's going to constantly be changing. So yes, I definitely see a trend in the more sort of clinical liaison, the clinical MSL. And I think companies can have both. You don't have to pull one away to sacrifice the other. You know, there are different models where you can have contractors that become permanent members of the team, and that takes away some of the risk if you think your pipeline might not make it. So I think there's different ways of doing it, and breaking out of this idea that it's the same MSL that has to do everything across that life cycle of the product. It's probably where we've got to get to.
Yeah. Fabulous. Sharon, a final word from you on this?
I totally agree with Kate. I'm in a pipeline role at the moment, and I think what we have to do is look at the skill set and capabilities that are needed by an MSL to fulfill a certain part of the role. And I think perhaps the early phase pipeline is a very different skill set to perhaps somebody that's working later in the life cycle. But for me, it's about the MSL having very clear instructions on what's expected of them. And I think back to a role I had where I worked with pipeline and in line as well. And it's that, what time are you expected to spend at this part, that part? What are your priorities? And, you know, what are the projects that you're going to lead on? So it's partly that, but also making sure you've got that skill set. And I think for me, that's the big part, because coming in and working with the clinical trials team, it's a very, very different role to perhaps just going out and delivering a clinical trial paper and, you know, perhaps doing some observational research. So skill set, clear guidance on what you're doing, and priorities as well.
Fabulous. So there's a question come in. I'm gonna throw this one to you, Paul. I don't know whether you can see it. With the increase in physicians using social media for collaborating and learning, we've seen the rise of online HCPs as digital opinion leaders. What are your thoughts on how online HCPs and digital opinion leaders should impact on the role of the MSL? So, Paul, is that a fair question to ask you?
I think that this question wouldn't even be asked. Sorry to suppose I know, Daniel, but I guess this question wouldn't be asked if we didn't sort of hold the traditional KOL with such reverie. Because if you were to simply approach this fresh and say, who has the most influence today? I don't think you would necessarily say that the traditional KOL is always the answer to that question. So I think we have to sort of climb slightly down from the mountain of the KOL, and we need to climb up a couple of new mountains. We've obviously just had a situation where over the last couple of years, all of the medical meetings have been digital. And as a result, those with the reach, the speed, the ability to translate complex scientific messages as far as broadly and easily as possible have kind of become the influences of today. And the fact that we might be sort of rating our sort of influences by their knowledge and their prestige only, to me, is a little bit frightening. I think there are many dimensions that should be considered. And obviously, we need to set ourselves up differently to work with digital opinion leaders because they're interested in different things, speed being one of them. You know, being the first one to break a piece of news is incredibly attractive for perhaps a younger group. Having the reach, you know, by using unconventional digital platforms, you know, you see doctors on TikTok these days, for crying out loud, you know, this might be the influence that we must be looking for. And the other half of it is, of course, being good storytellers. I always say that if Elon Musk can get people excited about batteries, then we as sure as hell damn it should be able to get people excited about health. Like the range of sort of storytelling, it doesn't have to confine itself to scientific data. I really think that we have to consider ourselves, you know, storytellers on the broadest possible plane that you can imagine that word to be, and simply bring the excitement of future discovery, the excitement of future healthcare options to life. And if we can do that, we're going to resonate not just with HCPs, but with a broader audience than that. So get the message right, and quality no longer means intelligent. It means much more than that. It means, you know, personable, etc. And then focus on new types of influences in a different way, definitely.
Thank you. Kate, you had your hand raised. So
yeah, I just want to follow up on that to the audience with a bit of a, you know, call to action or request, actually. And that's that, you know, we need to really explore this idea of the digital MSL. And I don't mean, you know, an avatar sitting at home. I mean, expert scientists working for organizations that also have a high social media presence, that are blogging, that are, you know, meeting those digital KOLs in the environment they like. So, you know, on Twitter. And that's going to cause a huge challenge for our compliance functions, right? So we all need to have that discussion with them to say, actually, we want to push this. And is tweeting information seen as proactive and therefore promotional? Or is it, you know, informed, balanced scientific exchange? So for me, this rise of the digital MSL, and again, it's not about the MSL being part of the omni-channel, but actually the MSL owning that. And really engaging in it and being in the same space as these digital influencers. That's where I'd love to see things going.
Kate, this music to my ears, and we heard this at MAPS. You and I were both at MAPS, and actually this was a really important panel conversation that happened on stage, if you recall. And companies, you know, the view from that panel was that we need to challenge our organizations, we need to challenge our compliance teams, we have to move with the times. Because I'm always thinking about, you know, what people need to know and to do to be most effective. You know, I think that the skills that we need are different. So again, this comes back to this evolving role. And incredibly, you know, we have 2 minutes left of our time together. And I just want to thank everyone for their engagement. The chat conversation in the background, as I say, there's a meeting within a meeting. So thanks to everyone for doing that. But I also want to offer a little bit of help to all of you who are sat there thinking about, what does this mean? You know, because these conversations really, I think, stimulate thinking, discussion. People go away and they think, my gosh, we look at the survey, you know, what does this really mean for our teams? So we have updated our development needs, our online development needs analysis tool, because this is what we talked to about the triangle of success. Scientific excellence is foundational to the success of every MSL. Of course, that's a given. But when we think about strategic acumen, and I saw that conversation happening in the chat, the importance of strategic and business acumen, that's absolutely paramount, combined with engagement excellence. So whether it's face-to-face, whether it's virtual, whether it's pre-launch, post-launch, whatever, the skill set is so different thinking about the scenario. And then, of course, we haven't even touched on the importance of emotional intelligence. So we have updated our online development needs analysis tools. So there are now 70 topics that we have called out. So that's both with respect to knowledge and with respect to skills. And it takes about 15 minutes to complete. We will send it to you as a link, send it to your team, and we will anonymize the findings for you and provide you with a summary of what your team are telling you. So they talk about importance to them and role, they talk about level of confidence, and they talk about learning needs. So if you are interested in receiving that as a tool from us, please just drop me an email or pop it into chat. I just want to say a massive thank you to all of our panelists for your contribution. It's been fabulous. I've so enjoyed the experience. I hope you have too. And a huge thank you to everyone who has joined us on the line, and hopefully we'll see you all very soon. Thank you.